Hi there, it's Melvin. Just wanted to take a moment to thank the team over at Thrizer for supporting this month's podcast sessions. Thrizer is a payment platform that you have to check out if you are a private pay therapist and accepting out-of-network benefits. It basically helps clients save on therapy upfront. Thrizer can help verify a client's out-of-network benefit ahead of the first session so that they get transparency up front on what their out-of-pocket costs will be. I'll tell you more about Thrizer here in the middle of our session, but if you go to sellingthecouch.com/Thrizer, you actually and then enter the code STC upon sign up, you get your first $2,500 in fees waived. Again, that's over at sellingthecouch.com/Thrizer, and be sure to enter the promo code STC. So we'll jump right into today's podcast session.
Welcome to the Selling the Couch podcast, where our goal is to help you achieve your counseling private practice dreams. And now, the man who once hiked across the canopy of a rainforest, psychologist and podcaster Melvin Varghese.
So yeah, I got to hike across the canopy of a rainforest. It was actually our honeymoon in Costa Rica. And so they have these bridges that are made out of metal, and they're these hanging bridges that are set up on the canopy of this rainforest. And you can get to certain parts where there's a clearing and you can see Arenal, which is an active volcano. I think it exploded the last time sometime in the 90s, but it was one of the most phenomenal things I've ever seen. Hey, what's up, everyone? Thank you so much for joining me for session 11 of the Selling the Couch podcast. Today's featured guest is Deb Owens. So Deb and I met through a meetup group for therapists in the Philadelphia area. Deb's a licensed professional counselor in private practice, but she also consults for a Fortune 100 company. So the thing that stood out to me about Deb is that she really cares about her clients. As she puts it on her website, "I've always been curious about the experiences of others. This is my superpower. I can't imagine doing any other kind of work." In today's session of Selling the Couch, Deb Owens shares a private practice journey that began 5 years ago, lessons that she's learned along the way, and some of her best advice for private practitioners. Here's my conversation with Deb Owens from debowens.com. Hey, Deb, welcome to Selling the Couch.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. My pleasure.
Deb, one of the things that when I have new therapists on, I love to ask them either a quote or a mantra that's guided them on their private practice journey. What would that be for you? And then more importantly, how could someone who's just getting started in private practice, how could they use that on their own journey?
Well, there's an old Hindu saying that there's many roads up the mountain and only a fool runs around the mountain telling everyone that they're going the wrong way. So for me, part of finding your voice and the type of practice you wish to have is to really get in touch with that there's lots of different ways and you don't need to emulate every person out there. You can find your own path, your own journey, and your own way to have a successful integrity-based practice.
I like that quote because it's such a great reminder, right? Like if you search online, there's therapists are all building all sorts of different practices. And I think what you're saying is at the end of the day, I think the most important decision to make is figure out what fits for you and what aligns with who you want to be.
Exactly. Authenticity.
Yeah. How did that quote, when you were first starting out, you know, in your private practice 6 years ago, how do you think that quote applied to you?
Well, I knew people who had been in private practice for a while, as well as new people. And I just think that over time, you know, I would look at what they've done. I'd look at their style. I'd look at the type of clientele they had. And I would benchmark myself and either feel I was a failure or a success. And over time, I learned that that just wasn't necessary. I had to decide what was right for me. And I don't think there's any way to hurry that when people try to take webinars and learn things and read things to say, can I do this quicker? Can I get up and running? I think you have to take your time. I think some of this takes a year or two to develop your voice, to develop your expertise, to develop your niche, to know how to find your road.
What I hear you saying is there's definitely like a psychological part to building a private practice. And a lot of it, it sounds like, is just about being patient on the journey.
No doubt. Unlike others, my first anxiety wasn't about filling my practice. It was actually whether or not I would like it and be good at it. That was my question. So when I had a full-time job and was just sticking one foot in and renting one day a week, co-space from someone else, I really was trying to find out, can I do this? Will I be good at it? Will I love it? Will, you know, I get good results? How will it work? Once I made that commitment, then of course, like everyone else, there was a period of anxiety, which lasted a good part of a year of, you know, how am I going to make this work? Having weeks where, you know, you get a couple cancellations and your first thought is, oh no. But over time, that goes away. You learn to ride with the ebbs and flows, to just ride the waves, to expect them to come back again and again. And then at some point, you find out that you're at capacity and you think like, wow, how did that happen?
Yeah, it's a great story. Just thinking back on your journey, right? As you were going from that place of feeling anxious and worried, how did you know you were making that transition from a place of always being worried about whether you were going to get clients to knowing that, hey, it's going to be okay?
Well, I think for me, the first year I was on insurance panels. And when I made that transition off panels, that was the high point of my anxiety because now I was charging a realistic and yet high fee for my services that was at least double what insurance would pay me. So I knew that that would take a little more effort. And for me, the only way to deal with the anxiety was really with data. So I started just with a pen and paper at the end of each week, writing down what my income was. Because in the beginning, when you go private pay, it's a little scary to have days when you only have three clients. But then you realize you're earning more income with three clients than you were with seven with managed care. So to me, it was really about the data and then also just having those ebbs and flows occur enough times that you habituate to it.
It's a very practical exercise, right? Like it, in a way, I think it takes the emotion out of starting any sort of a small business. As you've built your own private practice over the last 5 years, one of the things that, you know, you said that you've gone to kind of a private pay model. How did you decide to go the private pay route?
Well, lots of my colleagues take insurance, and I think that's fine. Many of them are in parts of the country where the insurance pays quite well and without hassle. But here in the Philadelphia area, it really is not the case. And my experience was that I wanted to do a hybrid at first. I thought I would stay on one panel and then build the rest privately and give out-of-network super bills. But over time, even the one panel I was left on, I just had one episode where I probably spent 11 hours tracking down a $600 payment that I knew was owed me and they agreed was owed me, but it took many, many months of effort and I just had it. So for me, part of it was just a spontaneous feeling towards the end of like, I'm done with this. I can be better than this. I can do better than this. My fear was that with a lot of people that you would then not be able to work with a range of people that come from different socioeconomic backgrounds. And I've actually found that's not the case. So it might have shifted a little. So maybe it goes from 80-20 to 70-30 in terms of the population. But overall, you know, it's really about value. And if people connect with you and feel you're the right resource and you were recommended to them and you get do excellent work and perhaps it takes them less time and sometimes they may not even have to come as frequently or as long a duration, and they accept that. They see the value of a quality practice.
Deb, what are some of the things that you do to build that sense of connection with clients to, you know, make them feel comfortable and wanting to work with you?
So, of course, part of it is that I really try to niche to three populations that I'm good at. And when people started in the beginning saying, you have to have a niche, you have to have a niche, you have to have a niche, well, I couldn't make that happen sooner than it happened. I had to practice and see different clients and find out who I did the best with and work with those populations. So obviously, most of it's about results. It's about that human connection. It's about taking extra time to come up with, you know, links that you might send them or articles or apps that you think of them at off times. I mean, part of the luxury of not seeing as many clients when you're private pay and not being as rushed is that you really do follow up. You get a release and talk to their doctor or their husband's therapist if they're in marriage therapy with you. You take that extra time. I go back to a turning point in my practice was when I actually on Craigslist found an old Mad Men era refrigerator that was actually a piece of furniture that looked like it came from a law office of somebody in the 70s. And I put that in my waiting room. And I remember struggling with, well, why should I spend $10 on water and put water bottles in there? And that was less money for me. But I finally just made that leap. And I know it sounds silly and not all my clients actually want the water, but it just created a vibe when they came in to give them the message, this is a different different kind of practice. I'm interested in your comfort. If you weren't able to stop for coffee at the coffee house, which is right down from my office, we have a machine there. People can make a cup of coffee, grab a water bottle, and just get comfortable. And as I said, even people who don't particularly take that, I think it sets a tone. And for me, the fact that I even sweated about that is kind of comical, and it just shows you how much I've changed.
I think there's something very powerful about that, right? Like in even in that process of offering coffee or having water there, it's in a way, I think you're starting to establish rapport.
Exactly.
What are some of the other things that you have done to build that sense of connection or trust with your clients?
Well, the truth is, and of course, it's a lot easier to do this since I've been full the last few years, but I really want to screen people before they come to see me. I really give them a message on every page on my website and in every conversation I have that I want to spend at least 10 minutes on the phone making sure I'm the right fit for them. Many, many times I refer people on to other therapists who I think are a better fit. And sometimes it's even issues that I'm comfortable with, but I look at it that, hey, I can do a B-plus job, someone else can do an A, and they deserve that. So part of it is that I really mean that and people pick up on that. If they are my perfect fit client, then we generally have a good rapport in the beginning because they know already that this is something I specialize in. And they tend to share a little bit more. And I have a kind of an attitude of confidence right away that I give off to them, which is, you know, real and legitimate. You can't make that up. I couldn't have had that my first year. I can only have it now.
You know, one of the things that you said was you go through that screening process of actually figuring out whether a client is a good fit for you or not. Tell us a little bit more about, you know, your specific screening process.
So what I found in my first year was that I had more intakes, and I would even go online and hear therapists bragging about how many intakes they had that year. And I realized that's not my goal. I want people that are going to stay with me, do good work, be a good fit, and remain in treatment. I want to have fewer intakes is what my goal was. So I think when I made that shift, part of the screening was to just be absolutely sure this is the right person for me. And I also want to make sure, unlike some therapists, I put my fees and the fact that I'm out of network right up in center. I even called the page fees and insurance, so it's not hidden anywhere. Because I did find in the beginning, a lot of therapist coaches would recommend to disguise that information or try to reel people in and then spring it on them. Not only did that feel disrespectful to me and ungenuine, but I never want to forget how much courage it takes someone to pick up the phone. So I didn't want to put someone in a position of calling me and then saying, ugh, I'm, you know, I really need someone on such and such panel. Although I'm very happy to help recommend people to be on panels and give them suggestions. But that was the idea.
I feel like you're bringing up, like the theme that's really sticking out for me so far in our conversation is really starting to see your private practice from the perspective of a potential client. And what are some of the ways that, big and small ways, that you can stand out and you can make potential clients actually feel like your services are worth pursuing?
Exactly. And even the way I handle my forms, I do have them on my website so they can download them, print them out, and bring them with me. But I make sure on the phone to not assume that people know the purpose of these forms. So, you know, I explain what it is on the phone. I explain to them, you know, that it's going to take about 15 or 20 minutes, that rather than waste time in the session, they can do that on their own and bring it with me. And even on the website, on my forms page, I say that again so they understand what informed consent is. You know, sometimes when you just throw that on people and they see a whole bunch of rules and regulations and things about confidentiality and legalese speech, it can be a turnoff. So I want to make sure to soften that a little bit by explaining that that's something that we're required to do and that it's important and that they take their time and read it through so that they understand the business agreement that comes with coming to therapy.
Deb, you're bringing up a good point, which is the importance of language, I think, both when we talk to our clients and also on our private practice websites. You know, before we talked, I spent some time just looking through your website, and I love the language that you're using on your website. And I wanted to more specifically spend some time just talking about your about page. What motivated you to write it in the way that you wrote it?
So that's another evolution. I don't particularly think my website is outstanding. I actually think it's fairly mediocre and average. what I did find on the About Me page was I really respected that a lot of younger therapists are much more comfortable putting their personal information out there. And I do believe that that helps engage clients. However, as a mom and a wife, I really don't want to share too much information. So I went from having a very technical sounding bio, which really just explained, you know, my degrees, my license, you know, where I work, that sort of thing, to trying to soften it, to add a little more voice in, to say a little bit about me personally. But I think if you read it, it doesn't go too far in that direction. That's just not my comfort zone. So while I'm willing to share a little bit about my personal journey, I really down-pedal it. And the only way I found to do that was that I actually wrote the first-person voice, the first part of the bio, which is really just me talking. And then I shift to the third person where I just kind of share what my credentials are. Because I do think that's important. And I do think that for some clients, it's not that important. But every once in a while, it gets someone, particularly someone who's educated, someone who's a physician or an attorney, and they want to know.
Deb, what are some of the things that you would encourage someone that's just getting started in private practice? What are some of those things that you would say it's okay to disclose on an about page or on a website versus some of the things that are not okay and that might be kind of, you know, stretching that line?
I don't know that even though I'm a very opinionated person, I actually am pretty comfortable with people making that choice themselves. I do think that parents of young children do need to think through, though, how their child is going to feel when they're a teenager. So I think sometimes people write these excellent blog posts and share a little bit of their foibles dealing with their six-year-old or seven-year-old, and it's cute and engaging, and I love it. I love reading them, and I find them exciting, but I do wonder, at 16, how is that person going to feel? So to me, you know, we all have different boundaries. We all have different expectations about that. I think everybody really has to make their own idea about that. For me, I'm probably a little more guarded than some people. I probably share a little less. On the other hand, since a third of my practice is couples and marriage counseling, I think people do want to know that I've been married for several decades, and that gives some credibility in that regard. I know some therapists talk about their own issues or struggling with anxiety. I don't really feel a need to go there. If I think it's appropriate with a given client, I may share that, but I don't really feel a need to put that out there on my web presence. But again, totally respect people that do and actually find it compelling.
What I hear you saying is it really should kind of depend on what feels comfortable for you. But at the very least, there's some wisdom in at least taking a step back and saying, what are the implications of what I'm putting out there?
Exactly.
Deb, one of the other questions that I wanted to ask you was, you know, now you've been in private practice here on 5 years. What would you say is the biggest business lesson that you have learned in these past 5 years?
I think in addition to what I talked about screening and only taking on clients that you feel really good about, has to do with just the basic things. On almost every online group I see of therapists, you see people constantly struggling with the issue of charging for a late fee. And I think that as the years go on, you do become more confident and a little more rigid of following through with that. But I also want to make sure I'm never so rigid that I don't take into account that many people have things come up. And I think sometimes it's fine to be flexible as well. And there's been times when I probably was too flexible and afterwards thought I blew it and I shouldn't have given that person a break. But I'd rather be that person than the one who, you know, holds the line and no matter what, this is the deal and never takes into account. You know, I have definitely a lot of young families that see me when a child gets sick at the last minute. I'm just not going to charge them for that. Now, if they do that 5 times in a row, I'm probably going to have to reconsider and have a conversation. But for the most part, I've trusted my clients to cancel if they need to. And I've not often had to charge them, but I will if I need to.
Deb, one of the other areas of, we've talked about this, of your website that you have started to blog fairly recently. So I wanted to pick your brain a little bit about that. How do you decide on what to blog about?
So, you know, I think my blogging is an example of how a little bit can go a long way because I'm really not a blogger. I think I put out maybe 6 posts a year. and they're fairly random. They're not on any theme. Unlike some people, I don't niche enough that I could make it everything about this. So I've seen some people that always blog about family issues or parenting issues. And then I think you really have a voice with that. And I actually respect that and think it's phenomenal. But I've ended up with more or less three areas that I specialize in. So my blogs tend to be all over the map that way. But they tend to happen with me organically. I know it would be great if I did it more regularly and if I put out shorter, you know, boosts of it and different topics, but I'm busy. My practice is full. I don't have a lot of time for it. I'm not a great blogger, but every once in a while, something percolates up in me. I start thinking about it for a few weeks. So my last blog was really, I was taking the train to Center City, Philadelphia. I kept noticing the yellow line up the railroad track. I started thinking about using that metaphor with clients, and I thought about writing it down, and a month or two went by before I did write it down, and I put it out there, and I talked about risk and taking risk and crossing yellow lines and what that meant. And again, it didn't get me a lot of organic SEO because that particularly blog post didn't have a lot of words in it that would come up naturally when people are Googling topics. But it also was just something that meant something to me in terms of a metaphor for the treatment process.
What I hear you say is, as much as it is for clients, I think part of it is your own journey, right? And what resonates for you. And really, if part of your inspiration is blogging, in blogging is what feels intuitively right and what really starts to resonate with you at an emotional level.
Exactly. And the fact is, even though my blogs are on my website, the fact is probably 90% of clients don't bother reading them. Those that do, if it resonates with them and it makes sense with them, then they'll bring that up usually in the initial phone call. And I'm happy that it gave them a window to my voice to make sure I was the right fit for them.
Deb, thank you so much for doing this. So we are at the Hot Couch Round. Are you ready?
I am.
What's a daily habit that you believe contributes to your success?
I do practice mindfulness.
What's an online resource that has been invaluable to your private practice journey?
So I do participate in some of the Facebook and Twitter groups for therapists, and I find that useful. There was one particular group that's a secret group, meaning it's closed and only open to 20 of us that started this journey together. Every single member of that group has gone on to have a kick-ass private practice, both group or individual. And we really learn from each other without a lot of marketing noise. We just kind of share freely with one another. And that's been an excellent help for me.
What's your favorite business-related book?
A particular book doesn't really stand in mind. What I've done is read Harvard Business Review, HBR, which has on a regular basis a lot of business articles that have nothing to do with therapy, nothing to do with our field, but to me just put me into a mind frame of understanding that business world. I do corporate consulting, particularly at a Fortune 100 company, which has kind of allowed me to understand that a little bit better as well, although even that doesn't translate well into a solopreneur type of private practice. But once again, I find that when I read articles in HBR that aren't written by therapists, that have nothing to do with therapy, they really make sense to me, and I can usually cipher through it and come up with something that's important for me to learn.
What's one tip that you would give to someone who's just getting started in private practice?
I think you have to pace yourself. I think with all the get-rich-scheme themes online where people are saying, you know, this coach can help you, you know, do it this way or do it that way, there's no way to hurry this. I think it takes a good 2 years, no matter what you do, to build into a full practice. Some people have young children at home or still working other jobs, so obviously that might take a little bit longer. But I also think the anxiety needs to just be tempered down, to have patience, to really trust, and I know this sounds simple, if you do good work, that over time, there's just a natural occurrence. And I've even had referrals from people, clients who I didn't think I did great work with, people that came to me and maybe they weren't really looking for therapy or they were ending their relationship and weren't wanting to commit to work on it. And still, I'll get a call a year later saying, you know, I was recommended by so-and-so. Those word-of-mouth referrals are gold. People come in with an expectation of success. They come in with an expectation that you're competent. They stay with you longer. I'm thrilled to get them because I know this person was referred by someone who either had a good experience with me or a colleague who knows me. So I make room for those people no matter how full I am for that reason.
And your last question is, imagine that you were starting your private practice all over again. You have $500 and your laptop. What is the first step that you would take toward building your private practice?
So I really think, even though I'm sure this has been beaten to death, but you must have a website in this day and age. And I do think even though some people are very good techies and are really good at creating their own websites, but if you don't have good SEO and it doesn't come up, then what good is it? So I actually think it's worth it to pay somebody with expertise to do a decent job. And you'll end up doing 80% of it yourself anyway, because you're the one that has to write the copy. But at least let that person help you with some of the more SEO or techie type things, and then you can keep it going longer. So to me, I think we're all wary in the beginning. You know, people don't have a lot of money when they're starting private practice. It's hard to take that leap of faith. But really, even people that are referred by word of mouth want to go to your website and get to know you. And many people don't get past that first page or two. So they're not going to spend hours looking at your site, but there's something there that makes them think you're the right person for them.
And Deb, you are off the hot couch.
Thank you.
Deb, if folks want to know about you, what is the best way to touch base with you?
My website is www.debowens.com. That's my name. I am primarily a therapist, so I see about 20 clients a week. 2 days a week, I do corporate consulting as a therapist on site at a Fortune 100 company. I have a monthly clinical supervision group that's been running for 4 years and is always full. As far as private practice coaching, I don't see myself competing or out there the way some of these coaches are that have these, you know, robust online media presence with, all kinds of webinars and graphic designs and web-based or whatever. What I've been doing is just kind of a three-session model where people get either phone or live or online coaching with me that's very authentic and very geared towards them and helping them. So I do it as a sideline. It's not my main business. It's not the main thing that I do. But I try to kind of be an alternative to some of the over-the-top things that are out there that really push people to sign up and spend thousands of dollars on, you know, experiences that, while they're helpful, may not be targeted specifically towards them. So I tend to do that the way I do my practice, which is narrow the focus, try to be the different person, the different voice, and to really just help people to find their niche, help them build good SEO on their website, help them make that journey if they're trying to shift from insurance to a non-insurance-based practice. So really share what's worked for me.
Awesome. Sounds great. Deb, thank you again.
Thank you, Melvin.
Hey, everyone. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Deb Owens. So I was taking away a couple of things from that conversation, the first of which is just the importance of language on our website. And I think especially in this day and age, it's very important to communicate on your website that you're a person and that you're relatable. And I think just the ability to do that goes a long way. This was really a struggle for me. I got so used to writing academically that it was a bit of a transition in learning to write just to an audience. So it's something that I would encourage you to continue to work on, and just being able to put things in a language that's easy to understand. So a website that I've actually come across recently is called Hemingway App, like Ernest Hemingway. It's an app where you can put in text, and it tells you at what sort of a reading level that your text is appearing. It's really cool and it's really handy. So ideally what you want is at about a 7th or 8th grade reading level. You know, the other thing that I was taking away is this idea of how much is too much disclosure. And I think the thing to remember is it really does vary for everyone. So, you know, for me on the blog, I tend to be a little bit more self-disclosing. Like, you know, I talk about the fact that I'm married, I have a picture of my wife and I. I talk about some of the stuff of growing up in India and coming to here in the US and some of my experiences. But there's also things that I don't talk about, and that's with intention. You know, I don't talk about my extended family because I want to kind of protect them. And I would say the same things for you. And I think whatever that line is for you, what are the things that you want to disclose on your website and what are the implications of that? But also, what are the things that you don't want to disclose? And so I, at minimum, I would say spend some time thinking about that and make an informed decision. All of the resources that Deb mentioned on today's session are available at sellingthecouch.com/session and the number 11. Thanks again, everyone, for joining me, and I'll see you on the flip side.
Thanks for listening to the Selling the Couch podcast. For more great content and to stay up to date, visit www.sellingthecouch.com.
So if you've been listening to the STC podcast for a while, or you've been listening to podcasts and you've had this thought of, Mel, I would love to launch my own podcast in order to grow my business, just wanted to encourage you to check out our free podcasting workshop, which is over at sellingthecouch.com/podcasting workshop. You can basically sign up at a day and a time that works for you. It's 90 minutes. And when I do these workshops or when I record them, I truly believe in the quality teaching, so it's going to be well worth your time. We're going to go through gear recommendations and how to launch strategically and how to think about monetizing your podcast and how to line up your podcast with your existing offers and how to do it strategically and authentically and not salesy and slimy and all of those things. So again, the link is over at sellingthecouch.com/podcastingworkshop.